Welcome to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. I'm Russ White. At 6 past the hour, a look at Pure Michigan's robust tourism industry, the Zika virus in Michigan, the state of the state's equine industry, and a Simon and Hollis conversation with Mark D'Antonio.
Coaching is teaching, and as long as you maintain that approach, empower your players and help them overachieve and provide growth for them as people, you hope that's what defines you, ultimately.
It's MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR, and we get started in 5 minutes.
Visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com.
MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
When I wander far away, a dream stays with me night and day. It's the road that leads to my home state. I am a Michigan man. Changing seasons paint the scene like rainbow trout in a hidden stream. The white-tailed deer in the tall pine trees. I am a Michigan man. I am a Michigan man, ask where I'm from and I'll show you my hands. Lord above, I love this land, I am a Michigan man.
You're tuned to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Kirk Heinze.
Well, the last few years have been good ones for the Michigan tourism industry, and will that role continue in 2016? Let's find out from two MSU tourism researchers who provide the industry and all the rest of us with an annual industry forecast. Dr. Sarah Nichols and Dr. Dan McColl, both of Michigan State University, have appointments in the Department of Community Sustainability, and Sarah is also appointed in the Department of Geography. Dan, Sarah, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having us back again.
Great to be here.
Dan, let's answer the question I posed in the intro. What are we looking at in 2016? Will the good times continue for the tourism industry?
Well, we do expect them to continue, and that's saying something because last year was a great year. But we do expect to see increase in the number of people traveling around the state, and especially in the amount that people will be spending. So those are two things we forecast. We predict a 3% increase in tourism volume, the people moving around the state, and a 5% increase in tourism spending.
And how did that compare to last year's numbers?
So last year, we had a very good year. We saw large increases in both spending and in tourism volume, more than we expected to see. And so we were a little cautious in being this optimistic about the current year, but there were enough indicators to suggest that the good times are going to roll on.
Sarah, sometimes when people see these numbers, of course, they want to. Their first question is, well, how do you arrive at these numbers? What's the methodology that you use to come up with your prognostications?
Well, Dan and I both spend a lot of time tracking a lot of numbers, economic numbers, transportation numbers. We also look at a lot of trends going on in the industry, in the state, nationally and internationally. And then we gather about a dozen industry experts from around the state. We present them with all of the information and come up with projections in the volume and spending.
Well, some of those data points that you gather include such things as currency exchange rates, hotel occupancy. How do you go about actually getting that? You must have some kind of a system because you're doing this every year.
We do have a system, so we keep track of all of the sources of these data, and we also have the students. We use students to help us gather all of the information. It's mostly, a lot of it's public information. It's just knowing where to look and taking the time to gather it and collate it all into usable forms.
Now, Dan, in this year's report, you guys talked about the importance of the millennial generation and the fact that they're starting to make a little bit more money, but they may travel a little bit differently than past generations.
Yeah, so, you know, one of the things we look at in the forecast are different tourism trends. And the millennials are something we've been eyeing for a few years, but now they're really starting to come into their spending years, their earning and spending years, and having a greater influence on the on the tourism industry. So yeah, they are much more. They make last minute decisions. They take shorter trips. They use social media and mobile technology a lot more than other generations. Although they're also influencing the older generation. So, you know, for instance, one of the things that's become very important in the tourism industry are reviews on sites such as Yelp or TripAdvisor. The millennials sort of lead the way in that, but other generations also have accepted this sort of these kind of sites and use them quite frequently.
You mentioned how the millennials like to vacation, like to travel. Is it a different sense of place for them? I mean, back in my day, it was you get a cottage up north and you would go to the cottage. You'd have a destination or a location. Sounds like the millennials are a little bit more fluid than perhaps the boomer generation.
I mean, one of the things that we're seeing with them is one of the unique things about this generation is they really are prioritizing their spending on experiences over stuff. And they want varied experience. They want authentic experiences. They want off the beaten track kinds of things. They don't necessarily seem to want the same routine kinds of things. So rather than going to a cabin, one single cabin up north every weekend, they might want to go to different places and do different things.
But then you still have the boomers and other generations as well who are continuing to support the tourism economy. Is their leisure and recreation and tourism behavior changed over time?
It has. So one of the things we're seeing, the baby boomers are still very important. With all the emphasis that's been put on the millennials, the baby boomers are still very, very important. And then my generation, the Generation Xers, we sort of get lost in there. But we're in our prime family years, and family travel is quite big. But with the boomers, there are so many of them. A lot of them are coming into retirement and therefore have more time for travel as well as money and inclination to travel. But one of the things that we're seeing is multi-generational travel. So a lot of baby boomers are traveling with their kids and especially with their grandkids. And that really is having an impact on the industry.
Well, I can speak. I went to two grandchildren and a third one on the way. We've done things in northern Michigan and Hawaii and Florida with our grandkids, and that's absolutely right. Well, we're talking about a very favorable tourism outlook for 2016 with Dr. Sarah Nichols and Dr. Dan McColl, MSU researchers and professors of tourism and recreation. I might mention, too, that their work is funded in part by our good friends at MSU Ag Bio Research. Sarah, you were heavily involved, to say the least, in the development of a strategic plan for the tourism industry. It's a plan that they continue to follow. Remind our listeners a little bit about the plan and some of the key components.
So this was a strategic plan that was developed by the industry in 2012. It's a five-year plan, so obviously it continues through 2017. There are eight goals, and those relate to things like public policy and increasing government support for the tourism industry, and particularly funding for Pure Michigan and the campaign. We have a goal related to the environment and our resources, so recognizing the need to simultaneously promote visitation to, but also protect all of our natural and cultural heritage, historical resources around the state. We're very interested in continuing to increase customer service across the state, so providing a really consistently superior experience for all of our guests. So those are just some of the items we're focusing on. Something else, a new initiative, is looking at our international students. So Michigan has one of the highest numbers of international students, not just here at MSU, also at U of M and many other of our colleges. So we really want to focus on encouraging them to travel more within the state. They tend to take trips to, you know, weekend trips to California, to New York, to Florida. We'd like them to stay here in Michigan and get to know the state a bit more. So we're working with the industry as well as the universities to really develop some programs to encourage them to travel more. And, of course, when their family visits, to take them around the state too.
You mentioned the social and cultural aspects of tourism, and that's also a major aspect of sustainability. We call it the socio-cultural aspect. Historical preservation, though, and things like that you just mentioned often sometimes are overlooked when we're talking about tourism and recreation in general. Very important in terms of a sense of place.
Absolutely. And I think placemaking as a theme is really beginning to gain a lot of traction right now. MSU Extension is working very hard on developing programs that really tie tourism into the broader theme of placemaking and generating really thriving, sustainable, again, economically, culturally, and environmentally, places that are not only great places to live and work, but also places for people to come and visit and perhaps relocate to, retire to, open a new business in.
Yeah, now I think, and either one of you can take this, but given the rebirth and renaissance going on in Detroit and some of the amazing historic buildings down there, a city like Detroit or a city like Grand Rapids can do a great deal in terms of economic development and also environmental sustainability by maintaining some of these places.
Absolutely. And actually, Travel Michigan has a brand new campaign this year, the Detroit Comeback Story. So if you jump onto Michigan.org, look up Detroit, the imagery on that site is fantastic. And it really does focus on the architectural heritage, on a lot of the environmental aspects that people perhaps aren't aware of. I was actually at the Westin Brook Cadillac yesterday for a training, and I spent my lunch hour in the Lafayette Gardens, which are a very small community garden, just a, you know, maybe a tenth of an acre, but just this green oasis surrounded by these fabulous historic buildings.
Yeah, and you mentioned this Detroit comeback story in your report as well to the tourism industry. Another thing, the uptick in visitation to our national parks, particularly the Sleeping Bear Dunes, much more so than the national average, apparently.
Absolutely. So the U.S. as a whole, there are about just over 400 National Park Service sites. Those sites saw an increase of about 5%. Here in Michigan, our sites had a 20% increase. We had 10% at Sleeping Bear Dunes, close to 30% at Isle Royale, and almost 40% at Pictured Rocks. So we had this boom in visitation. And of course, this year is the centennial of the National Park Service, so we're hoping to at least maintain those numbers. It would be hard to replicate double-digit increases at all of them. But the National Park Service has a Find Your Park campaign. They're encouraging every American to get out and visit a national park site this year.
In addition to the campaign, what do you attribute all the uptick in visitation to the national parks? I mean, that's a huge. And again, it's not just in Michigan, but it was national. I mean, is it a function of a recovering economy or wanderlust or a combination of factors?
I think it's a combination. And I think something that we talked about at the tourism conference this year is how our travel agency, Travel Michigan, does partner with the National Park Service to a greater extent and stronger extent than happens in some other states. So they do a much better job of encouraging people to come and visit our national parks. Pictured Rocks was very heavily featured in the new IMAX film, The National Parks Adventure. So that should be a great showcasing of that attraction. I think it's a combination of the Pure Michigan campaign is continuing to work. And we do have these sort of undiscovered gems in the state that people are discovering.
I'm talking with a couple of tourism researchers from Michigan State University, Dr. Sarah Nichols and Dr. Dan McColl. Dan, I want to come back to something you mentioned earlier, and it's about the use of social media in the planning of one's vacation or one's travels and how important that is and how particularly millennials and younger people are doing that. But elaborate on that a little bit more.
Yeah, so we've actually done some research on this in how new technologies are impacting tourism. And not just social media, but the use of mobile devices is something that is really surprising. So we've done some research in the past year to see how people use mobile devices for things such as planning their trip before they go, for navigating while they're on their trip, for planning while they're traveling. And one of the surprising things we saw is before people even travel, they're using their mobile devices to plan their travels almost as much as they are their desktops or laptops, which is quite surprising to see that. And you know, for the industry, this means that they have to pay greater attention to how their websites look on mobile devices. There's a lot of things that an organization or a destination can do to make their site mobile friendly, and that's becoming a more and more important thing. And people are relying more on their mobile devices while they're traveling, not only for navigation, but for it's changed the way people experience travel. You know, the use of social media and having access to the internet right there in the palm of your hand means that people are sharing their tourism experiences as they go, and they're getting feedback on those experiences as they go, and they're getting recommendations, and they're reviewing sites as they go while it's fresh in their minds. Oftentimes sitting down at a table of a restaurant at the end and reviewing their meal right there on Yelp or TripAdvisor.
Yeah, again, I mentioned having just gotten back from Disney with the grandkids, but it's amazing what you can do on mobile. Even as you're walking around the site, you can see how long the line is at the next venue or what have you. And daughter and son-in-law were looking at their phones pretty much the entire time. One question I like to ask you folks every year because of the nature of this show, and it's I don't know that it's part of the data that you gather, but this whole business of green tourism and young people looking for venues that are good for the environment, hotels, for example, biking and hiking trails. Any thoughts on green tourism, any changes you're seeing?
Actually, I was just reading a report about this the other day that was quite interesting. It said that about 60-65% of people are looking for sustainability practices at their hotels they're staying at, but about the same proportion of them can't actually define sustainability. So it's sort of an interesting irony. I think people have a broad concept of sustainability, and they want to feel as though they're doing the right thing, but perhaps they're not really necessarily sure exactly what that means in the context of a hotel or a restaurant as far as what they should be looking for as far as the practices that these places are offering.
And the other thing about this is, you know, oftentimes sustainability practices can be a little bit more expensive for the tourism industry. But people expect them, but they're not necessarily willing to pay more for them. They might pay a little bit more for it because it's important to them, but they're not going to pay a lot more for it. And this is a real challenge for the industry as they try to do the right thing and do the things that their consumers want while, you know, sort of maintaining their cost portfolio.
And we've talked to a couple, for example, vineyard owners who are MEEP certified, and they say that people don't necessarily come in and ask about the sign or what have you, but they say, they may mention what is that sign. And so what they're doing is they're taking the opportunity to educate their consumers on their green practices. So they're taking the initiative, not so much waiting for the customers to ask the questions.
Yeah, it's interesting. So I've done a lot of research on wineries and tasting room visitors in last year. But one of the things we did last year, so one environmental goal that fits really well with the wineries is sort of the local movement, right? A lot of people who are interested in local foods and local wines are interested because it's environmentally friendly. So we did a study last year to figure out how much people are willing to pay for a wine based on information they get about the wine. And one of the types of information that we gave people about the wine was about the local nature of it. The grapes were grown locally. It supported businesses in the local community, et cetera, et cetera. And people were willing to pay a little bit more for that, but not nearly as much as they were when they heard that the wines had won awards. That is something that they will pay for, a perceived quality, whereas the local doesn't seem to increase their value of the wine quite as much. And so figuring out what wineries and other tourism businesses communicate to people and how they educate them, as you talked about, is quite important.
We've just got about a minute left here, but let's get in a plug. Sarah mentioned it earlier. I think you both did. Pure Michigan, the importance of continuing that campaign. It's been a major success story, but we have to absolutely remind people how important it is.
Absolutely. And every year, Travel Michigan commissions a study to look at the return on investment. So this is sort of a measure of how much the state treasury gets back for every dollar that it invests in the campaign. That number last year reached $7.67. So for every dollar the state puts in, they're getting almost $8 back. That's a huge return, and it's really indicative of the importance of the industry and the value of continuing to invest in that campaign.
Yeah, and beyond the Travel Michigan study, you know, as we interact with tourism businesses around the state, one of the things that a lot of them do is track where their visitors are coming from. And there has been a large increase in the number of people from outside the state coming to Michigan as a result of in the time that the Pure Michigan campaign has been going on. And so even though that doesn't suggest even though we don't know if the people are coming because of that, it seems very likely. It's a very high correlation. And the good thing about out-of-state visitors is they tend to stay longer and they tend to spend more when they're in the state.
Well, a lot of good news about the Michigan tourism industry, another positive year in the offing. I know there are always unforeseen variables that could happen, but let's hope we have good weather. Let's hope the economy continues in the right direction, and let's hope that that 5%, 3%, 3% prediction, you guys have been pretty good in the past few years. You hit those numbers right on the button. I've been talking with Dr. Sarah Nichols and Dr. Dan McColl, who are tourism and recreation researchers at Michigan State University. Their work is supported in part by MSU Ag Bioresearch.
WKAR.
I am a Michigan man. Ask where I'm from and I'll show you my hands. I am, by God, I am a Michigan man. I am a Michigan man, where sleeping bears lie on the sand. Manitou has placed his hands. I am a Michigan man.
Tune to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Kirk Heinze.
Well, we often discuss the important interface between agriculture and tourism and recreation on this program. And is there a better example of that than horses? With us to discuss the Michigan equine industry is Dr. Karen Waite, an extension specialist at Michigan State University who teaches and advises equine students in the MSU Department of Animal Science. Karen, a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Karen, in general terms, I mean, I know there's a lot more to the equine industry than tourism and recreation, but that's a large part of it. A little bit about the importance of the equine industry to the great state of Michigan.
I think it's really important to recognize how different the equine industry is from some of our other animal, ag, and commodity type groups. It really is a population that travels a lot, so it's not unusual to see lots and lots of horse trailers on the roads in any given weekend doing all sorts of things that horses do. So they do move a lot. That means that they do, or their owners do, wind up purchasing gas, using hotels, restaurants, that sort of thing in any particular area. So they're a really strong contributor to the economy in the state of Michigan in a lot of ways that people don't think of.
When folks think of the equine industry or they think of horses, they can come at it from a number of different perspectives. There's the 4-H programs, there's racing, but it's multidimensional. Talk a little bit about that.
It really is. That's one of the cool things. There are a lot of cool things about the horse industry, but one of the coolest from my perspective is that there's really something for everyone. So 4-H programs and 4-H fairs. We have a limited racing industry in Michigan, but we still have people that fair race and take their standardbreds and their harness horses to fair races. There are lots of people that show and quite a large number of people that trail ride. So, again, all of those activities with multiple breeds of horses. So if you have an interest in horses, there's probably a breed that you'll find more interesting than another. And so the possibilities are really pretty endless for interests and activities with horses.
Yeah, I've had, and back in my day, I had a lot of students who came through the A&R Communications Program who went to work for horse publications or in different breed associations. What are the most popular breeds in the great state of Michigan? Are there one or two that sort of stand above the rest as far as numbers?
Oh, definitely. And it follows national trends probably in many respects. But the American Quarter Horse is probably the number one breed in the country and the world and in the state of Michigan. In Michigan, it is a little bit different, but we do have a large number of Arabian horses in the state of Michigan. And a big contributor to that is probably the fact that Michigan State University has been a leader in breeding Arabian horses. W.K. Kellogg imported the first Arabian horses. So the Arabian horse has a long history in the state of Michigan. So we probably have more Arabians in Michigan than maybe some other states do, but primarily American Quarter horses, Arabians, and paint horses are also very popular.
Well, that's a nice segue for people who haven't been to the MSU Equine Research and Teaching Center. Beautiful horses out there. I had the pleasure of being out there not long ago with my granddaughters, but particularly the Arabians you have out there are spectacular animals.
They really are. And another thing that people don't really realize is that Michigan State has the third longest continuous running purebred Arabian breeding herd in the country. And so those horses that we got from Mr. Kellogg in the early days are still, those bloodlines are still with us today. And we've been able to do some phenomenal things. Our barn manager, Paula Hitzler, teaches students at that facility as well. And we've had multinational champions. We'll have 15 foals roughly on the ground this year. I just stopped there on my way in this morning to see some of them out front. So it's open every day for the public to visit, and it is a beautiful facility. We are able to show those horses because of a group called Friends of the Horse Teaching and Research Center that fundraises so that we're able to do that. But we do have a very successful herd.
My guest is Dr. Karen Waite. She's an MSU Extension Specialist who teaches and advises equine students in the MSU Department of Animal Science. Karen, about 10 years ago, you were involved in a major study that was largely funded by the horse industry itself, looking at economic impact. There was a number of $1 billion with a B impact on the state of Michigan, about 150,000 horses. 10 years later, where does the industry stand?
That's a great question, one we'd really like to answer. It's a little challenging with the horse industry because we don't have a state or federally funded survey every year like some of the other commodity groups do. So if we want those numbers, we as an industry have to generate the dollars to pay for it. But I would say because the horse industry goes the way of the economy typically, because we saw a bit of a drop off several years ago, and that's putting it mildly, and it lasted quite a while, we've probably had a bit of a drop off in horse numbers. But as someone who judges quite a bit and is involved in the industry a great deal, I would say that it is coming back, and I'm optimistic. But we do need to do another survey to get a handle on just where we are. I do think that another thing your listeners might find interesting is that the horse industry is different in that it's primarily a service industry. So it really isn't necessarily the number of horses that would indicate how successful the industry is, but more the goods, the services, the trucks, the trailers, the things that change hands that really would indicate the strength of the industry.
Karen, when we talk to other folks on this program about recreation and tourism, we talk to folks fishing, hunting. There's a real concern about kids not getting outdoors as much anymore, and that has all sorts of implications, spiritually, physically, what have you. Is there a concern within the industry about young people getting out in nature, getting on horses? I mean, is that stable, or is that something that folks worry about in terms of the future of the industry?
We do worry about it, actually, quite a bit. Society has changed so much in regards to, as you say, getting outside. Society has also changed from a liability perspective, whereas when I was a little kid, it was not unusual for people to say, hey, go ahead and jump on my horse and ride around the subdivision. Well, you don't do that anymore, really, because people are afraid of lawsuits and other things that might happen. So it is a concern as to how young people get introduced to horses. That is one reason why I feel like the Horse Teaching and Research Center at Michigan State is such a contributor to the industry, if for no other reason the fact that we get about 60,000 visitors a year, which gives young people, kids who may never have been exposed to a farm or a horse, the opportunity to do that. So that's definitely a plus. I think we'll see lots more young people get exposed to horses via camps and those kinds of activities than we ever have before, but it's definitely an issue.
The tourism reports over the last 3 or 4 years by colleagues at Michigan State have been very positive, and they've been right. We just heard from Dan McColl and Sarah Nichols that we're expecting a 5% increase in tourism spending this year. That has to have a ripple effect with respect to the horse industry.
I think it really does. And we do see people coming to Michigan to use our trails. We have the shore-to-shore trail ride across the state of Michigan, which is very unique and people come here for that. Lots and lots of horse shows. We have a great showgrounds in Ludington in addition to the one here at Michigan State that are really tourism / horse show destinations for folks. So there's lots to do here with horses, and I think we'll see a similar uptick.
Well, I know we're talking MSU here, but I'm very pleased. My alma mater, Albion College, is expanding its equine center. They got a big grant to do that, and they're trying to do some more things down there as well. So I think that's just indicative of some of the things that you have been talking about. For folks listening to this program, parents, maybe they've been talking to their kids about getting involved in horses. What's some advice that you might give them, and where can they go for more information in addition to the MSU Teaching and Research Center?
I would say every community has a lesson barn, or if your young person is interested in giving it a try via a camp situation. We still have lots of camps in Michigan and northern Michigan, the west side of the state as well. So either getting involved with horses via a camp or potentially contacting your extension office in your county with regards to local riding stables. I don't know if people have phone books anymore, but there usually are. I'm guessing no, but you could Google local riding stables in your area, I suppose, if you don't have a phone book. But just about every area of the state has some type of lesson facility, and I would really encourage parents to start out with lessons.
Well, a lot of good reasons to get involved with the equine industry, and very optimistic outlook after some tough years that we've all had in the great state of Michigan. I've been talking with Dr. Karen Waite. She's an extension specialist at Michigan State University, works with equine students at MSU Department of Animal Science. Karen, thanks so much for being on Greening of the Great Lakes.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. It's been great.
You're tuned to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's more with Kirk Heinze.
Well, for the past several months, there has been much in the news about the Zika virus, which is transmitted by the yellow fever mosquito. And the primary concern has been pregnant women contracting the virus. With respect to Michigan and the Great Lakes region, what do we need to know about Zika as we move into mosquito season? Well, here to tell us is Dr. Michael Kaufman, Associate Professor of Entomology at Michigan State University. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with a bit of a primer for our listeners on the Zika virus. Where does it come from, and to where has it spread?
So it's a virus that, as far as we know, originated in Africa and has spread through parts of French Polynesia into Asia. And most recently, the widest spread is in South America, Central America areas.
One of the most virulent aspects of this is the tendency to cause microcephaly among infants. What actually happens in those cases?
So I think a lot of it remains a little bit unclear, but it appears that the virus somehow bridges from the mother to the developing infant, infects the brain tissue, and I think there's some recent research going on to try to determine which particular cells in the brain are affected and why Zika, this particular virus actually hits those cells. There are a lot of viruses transmitted by mosquitoes, including some in Michigan, that are what we call neuroinvasive, right? So you're probably familiar with West Nile.
You've certainly heard West
Nile, and that's going to be a recurring thing. We don't know what's going to happen these 2 years, but that's also a neuroinvasive virus in the same family as Zika. So it just doesn't, as far as we know, affect infants, and that's kind of the question as to why Zika is, particular in being able to invade the brain cells of developing infants.
Well, this program has a Great Lakes and a Michigan focus, so let's talk about the likelihood of Zika here in Michigan and in the Great Lakes region. There are a lot of questions, particularly among young mothers or pregnant women or those who are about to begin families, but what would you say to them?
Science is always a matter of probabilities, right? And my contention would be that the probability of anyone in Michigan picking up Zika via mosquito is extremely low. We don't have the mosquito species that we know transmitted in the tropics, so we don't have those particular mosquitoes here And it's unknown exactly, you know, how competent some of our native mosquitoes are. I mean, it's, again, I tell people it's probably in the lightning strike, you know, probability numbers, you know, very, very unlikely. The only time the Zika is going to come into the into Michigan is via a traveler, and we've had cases already. There have been several people who have been diagnosed with Zika who have traveled to some of the areas. Puerto Rico is one to really be watchful of. But once they get here, then, you know, a particular mosquito, you know, would have to bite that person. And then not only that, you know, live long enough for the virus to kind of increase in the mosquito, and then it would have to find another person to bite. And the reason that, I mean, we have mosquitoes that would potentially do that in Michigan, but the Aedes aegypti mosquito, the one you introduced at the beginning of the program, is really, really tied into humans. So it is attracted to humans. It likes to bite humans first. Many of our mosquitoes around here, they'll bite a human, and if, you know, then they need another meal, your dog is going to be, you know, just as likely to, you know, provide blood for it as, or deer, or, you know, some other mammal that, that you'd find. So that's kind of a long answer to your question, but I think the risk.
No, but it's a good answer to the question.
Thanks. But I think the risks for, you know, any, you know, person in Michigan are really, really low. We can't say zero, but, you know, really, really low.
We're talking about the Zika virus with Dr. Michael Kaufman, who's an associate professor of entomology at Michigan State University. Mike, a lot of communities, though, not just in Michigan, but around the United States, are taking what they think are proactive measures, which often includes a lot of spraying of pesticides and what have you. Seems to me, based on what you just said, that number one, that might be a waste of money, and number two, it's not particularly good for the environment.
Depends on where you are in the United States, I'd say. So I think there are certainly southern states that have a higher risk. Florida being a really good example, places in Texas and some of the species of mosquitoes you can find, and even in Arizona and California, but they tend to be southern. Hawaii would be another, you know, United States state, territory, or whatever, that potentially has the mosquito and could transmit Zika locally. There are two, to complicate the stories, there are two species that we think may be involved. The first, the yellow fever mosquito, is what most people think is the primary one. There's the Asian tiger mosquito, another invasive species that has a more northern distribution. And that, you know, if you're in an area with that mosquito, the risk, you know, increases relative to, say, those of us in Michigan, which we don't have either of those species here.
But that latter species you mentioned has moved further north, right?
Yeah, it's established. It's actually, exactly. So the worry, and in fact, I'm involved in this, and the state of Michigan is involved in looking for Aedes albopictus in areas of Michigan, you know, with the idea that it, if you have these populations and somehow Zika comes into a neighborhood or whatever, there could be, you know, minor local transmission. But that would be the most serious one. The yellow fever mosquito, even though if somebody brought some up here and started a, you know, population, you know, inadvertently or on purpose or whatever in the summer, it could do pretty well, you know, during a few months of our summertime, but it would never last through the winter. So it'd have to be like brought in, you know, every year for that. So back to your question about, you know, spraying and things, I think it actually is not necessarily a bad idea to be proactive in areas where you know you have Aedes aegypti. Aedes aegypti has in fact spread dengue and chikungunya locally in places in Florida. So these are diseases transmitted by the same mosquito. And, you know, again, there was enough of an influx of traveler, you know, related human people with diseases, and then the mosquito's already there, so it was able to transmit in some areas. So if you have that, if you're in an area where you have Aedes aegypti, I'd say the, you know, extra, you know, spraying or whatever is probably warranted. Then it gets a little iffy, in my opinion, as to whether just because you have albopictus, you're going to go blanket, you know, spraying, you know, in an area. It's not, again, it's not impossible. If we had albopictus, I'd say our risk in Michigan was, you know, elevated, but not, but still, you know, relatively low to moderate for that. Most of the people that I know, in mosquito control, either in districts here in Michigan or in private companies, are really very, very good at how they apply the pesticides. And if they're reputable and, you know, professional about it, the environmental impact is, should be, you know, relatively
yeah.
low. Yeah. So they use, if, for example, I mean, the common thing that people think about with mosquito spraying is, you know, like a truck coming down the street and, you know, spraying
right.
stuff all over. And it is a general insecticide, but it's has low toxicity, you know, for mammals and all that. And the formulations that are used under those circumstances, it's very low volume. It's really directed at small flying insects. And if they spray at night, you know, the majority of things are going to be hitting our mosquitoes. And it doesn't last very long. That's one of the key things. Once you, you know, this particular formulation, if you spray it, it's not like it lies around for weeks and weeks. It dissipates and becomes inactive, you know, fairly quickly. So there's a, so there are concerns. There are concerns. People in my department who are experts on pollinators,
right.
you know, for
right.
example, you know,
we've done some stories on that for this program, right?
Yeah, yeah. So the there, so yeah. there is some, you know, a lot of beekeepers are. Don't like
right.
mosquito control people. Mm-hmm. And I think some of that is unjustified because actually, again, the mosquito control people that I know of go out of their way to avoid, you know, spraying in areas. Again, they usually spray after bees are active and the stuff doesn't last very long. But again, these are general insecticides, so you can never, you know, really say, okay, there's zero effect.
A couple of take-home messages for
sure.
young mothers who might be or pregnant or what have you listening to this program.
Gotcha.
What are some of the precautions they should be taking?
Right. So the biggest precaution you should be taking, if you're traveling to areas with Zika, then you want to make sure that you're, you know, located in a place which has air conditioning, window screens, you know, avoid these mosquitoes. Use a good repellent if you're going to be exposed to it. The other half of this question, which is fairly unusual for similar viruses, is that it can be sexually transmitted.
Right.
So if you know, if you have a partner, husband who's been traveling to areas like that, and even though he may not be showing symptoms, right? Zika's,
right.
You know, you can get Zika and maybe not show symptoms. You should have him checked before you have sex or, you know,
and
or take precautions,
yeah.
you know, when you have that, because that's, you know, that's the other way. I would actually say that people in Michigan are more at risk of, you know, getting Zika from a sexually transmitted act, you know, versus a mosquito.
Than Aedes aegypti. Right.
Exactly. Yeah, much more.
Right. Well, we've been getting the straight scoop on the Zika virus. And for more information, I know the Center for Disease Control has a lot of information.
Really excellent.
You've written some papers for MSU Extension. People can just Google, I would imagine, Zika virus, but look for MSU Extension as
exactly.
one source of information.
Exactly.
My guest has been Dr. Michael Kaufman, Associate Professor of Entomology at Michigan State University. Mike, thanks for clearing up some of the myths and getting us straightened out on all things Zika.
My pleasure.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with a sustainability-focused Greening of the Great Lakes segment inside MSU Today here on AM 870 WKAR. To read Kirk's blog and hear more Greening of the Great Lakes content, visit mlive.com/environment. This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis now welcome MSU head football coach Mark D'Antonio to MSU Today. Here's A.D. Hollis.
Well, we're just, you know, just coming off the spring game, and this is the summertime, so this is an opportunity for you to look back at what happened throughout the spring as we prepare already for fall camp. And I know your staff's busy at work, but kind of give us a reflection about what you saw in the spring and where you see the program heading going into August.
Well, first of all, I think we've got a football team that expects to win. And so they're motivated by that aspect. You know, obviously we graduated some very good players, and they've gone on to the draft, and they've gone on to their respective teams. So we'll miss those guys, but that's the cycle of college athletics. I think we have a very good young team. They've got a basis, junior-led team sort of, got some seniors that are very strong as well, but I think it's more of a junior-led team in the respect that you know, when you group the juniors and seniors together, it's pretty strong. We've got a lot of guys who've played a lot of football here, and the expectations are high. There's certain position groups that are very, I think, deep, but I think we tackle well on the perimeter on the defensive side of the ball. We've got some big play wide receivers, got three very good backs. I think our quarterback situation is going to be solid, and I think we didn't lose a coach again this year, so I think what we've tried to do is critique what we've done and try to improvise and get a little bit better. So we're going to find out what that's all about as we get into August. But feel good about our football team. Right now, I think we're 22-2 or 23-2 maybe. I'm in the Big Ten Conference in the last 3 years. So, you know, we've got a chance.
Notre Dame is back on our schedule for the next 2 years. Talk a little bit about that being back in
Yeah, that's I think that's a rivalry game. And, you know, you read back the history of Michigan State. They were largely responsible for us getting in the Big Ten. So, a great opponent. They play a very tough schedule. I think the game will be at Notre Dame this year. It should be a nationally televised game. And I think what you see now happening in college football, you see Ohio State playing Oklahoma and you see, you know, LSU playing Wisconsin. There are big games on the docket for Big Ten teams. Mm-hmm. And you multiply that with 9 conference games and you've got a strong schedule for every football team that's in the Big Ten. If they're going to go anywhere, do anything with it, they're going to have to play somebody real. And, you know, Notre Dame's a real opponent.
When you turn your eyes back to Spartan Stadium, we have an opportunity. We'll host once again a Friday night game, which leads into Labor Day weekend, part of the opportunity to let folks celebrate, you know, closing down the cottages and enjoy that Labor Day weekend. But we also have BYU, Ohio State, Michigan, several other really good home games. And that's, you know, you look at that from the advantage of winning games, but you also look at the advantage that has in propelling recruiting for football, recruiting for all mm-hmm. sports, opportunities on campus for various colleges to have large celebrations. So it's really it's a home schedule that really plays a positive in so many different aspects.
It really is. You know, we play Wisconsin here as well, and so all those games are going to be packed. Wisconsin travels, so does Ohio State, so obviously does Michigan. Somehow they creep in there. But, you know, so it's a great, attractive home schedule, and our guys are going to be excited to play. And we're tough. We're especially tough in Spartan Stadium. And, you know, we get our students are very much involved. You know, we had 500 students come out to practice last week. We've had them, mm-hmm. or a couple weeks ago, I guess, and then also, you know, run out for the spring game. So that was an exciting event as mm-hmm. well. So so we have a lot of people back in the Spartans, and right now it's a feel-good story, so we got to keep it that way.
You know, it is a very tough schedule, and you talk about winning. You know, and football coaches, you know, have to be sort of a triple threat in terms of, you know, obviously the games issue, but also this academic performance and the capacity to develop people. And, you know, obviously over the last period of time, we've been really good at all three of those things. And this is a really, from my perspective, this 9-game Big Ten season makes it really tough. I think we're playing with BYU and Notre Dame, probably one of the tougher schedules out there. In terms of adding that to the mix. And, you know, young teams are young teams. And so I just enjoy the fact that we're a program, and we're a program to be contended with no matter who's on the list of the Big Ten or nationally. And if you think about when you came and where we are now, you know, independent of what the exact number is going to be next year, you know, we're a program to be contended with. We'll be a program to be contended with the next year and the next year and the next year because we built the depth. You've recruited kids of quality. Not perfectly, because you can't recruit 18-year-olds or 16-year-olds with perfect sight, but by and large, the proportions are really good, and that's really the part that I think for university is so critical, to have the right people, the right values, and always build towards a sustainable program. And this is really, you know, there are some coaches who don't like me saying this, and some people, but you know, you'd have to look a long time to find Michigan State in this position. And there are very few places around the country that are actually in this kind of program definition moment. And you've helped get us there, and we thank you for that. And it's going to be fun to watch these young kids, you know, particularly some of those wide receivers.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I really think that coaching is teaching. truly, if you get into coaching, you need to get in for the right reasons, you know. And you know, right now you're the head coach of Michigan State. I understand all the things that go along with that financially and everything else, responsibility-wise and all that. But coaching is teaching, and as long as you maintain that approach, empower your players, and help them overachieve and provide growth for them as people, you hope that that's what defines you ultimately. But I keep telling our players, you know, anticipate the difficult by managing the easy. And that's what we've done here. We've managed the easy. You know, as easy, it's difficult. But if I stand up there and say we all have to go in one direction on the first day I got this job, we can be champions.
And you had
that's an easy statement.
And you had your Ohio State ring on to prove it.
Yeah. That's the only ring I had at that time.
Yep.
But that's easy to say that. That's easy to say that. Yeah. Much more difficult to do. But if we just move together, and you two have been really instrumental in our success, I really mean that, because there have been tough times, but every time that there's been a tough time, you know, you guys have provided the support in all sincerity, and you know, that's how you get to the top. It's great to see our players' dreams come true. It's great to see our dreams come true, all of ours. I remember, Mark, you talking about our feet, our cleats being in the middle of the Rose Bowl. So that's what you do. That's what you're trying to do, you know. And I've said it before, you know, I think I was hired here to try and make people happy. So I'm trying. Doesn't mean I golf great, okay, but I'm trying. So we'll just keep trying to move in that direction. And, again, I'm just humbled to be here.
Well, you have made people happy, and keep yourself happy too.
Right. That's
go green.
Take care.
Thanks, guys. Go White.
That was Spartans head football coach Mark D'Antonio talking with his bosses, Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis. To hear an extended version of the conversation, please visit SpartanPodcast.com.
Bad snap. Bobble. Oh! Scooped up. Here come the Spartans. Down the sideline. Racing into the end zone.
Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me?
Racing into the end zone is Jalen.
Oh, my God.
Watts. Jackson, touchdown, MSU!
Touchdown!
Folks, no flags! The
no
Spartans
flags!
Oh my God! Piling on each other in the end zone! It's over! The Spartans win again!
Oh my God!
The
oh my
Spartans God. Win again!
Fight, fight, rock team, fight! Victory for MSU! Hey!
WKAR.
MSU Ag Bio Research is really centered around leading research and developing scientific discoveries in the areas of food, energy, and environment.
Doug Buehler leads MSU Ag Bio Research.
Our history bases us in Michigan, but we've really expanded that mission to the nation and to the world.
MSU Ag Bio Research has more than 300 scientists representing 7 MSU colleges.
We're very interested in continuing to build international linkages because of the importance of what we do and the global nature of agriculture and the global nature of a lot of the problems that we currently face.
MSU Ag Bio Research is leading research and scientific discoveries in the areas of food, energy, and the environment in Michigan, the nation, and around the world.
The core is that we do research on food, energy, and agriculture. The reality is that those three things are important to everybody every day of their life.
Visit agbioresearch.msu.edu.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. To hear this show again, click on the radio tab at WKAR.org and scroll to MSU Today every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock on AM 870 WKAR.